Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Everyone can get their seats. I think we have some sodas and beverages back there. Please feel free to grab one and bring it to your chair. Well, we usually do these book events. We usually have this room split into another third, and there's usually about 15 or 20 people here, so we've clearly exceeded that, obviously because of all the publicity and notoriety that Paul has, Broadwell's effort here on General Petraeus that we're gonna discuss today. So first of all, thank you all for coming. My name is Rick Ozzie Nelson. I'm the director of the Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Program, actually co-hosting this event our friends from WISE. And I'll talk about them in a second, but we're just thrilled. The reason why I'm doing this, what does that have to do with counterterrorism and Homeland Security, is because Paul Broadwell is a friend of mine for many years through the Council on Foreign Relations, back when we were, you know, just term members and youngers and trying to figure out what we were going to do, and now she's a world-famous author, and I work at a think tank. It's good. I want to thank the Women International Security for putting this event together, for doing most of the heavy lifting. WISE is the only global network of actively advancing women's leadership at all stages of their careers. That's what it says right here. International Peace and Security have more than 7,000 members in 47 countries. I've done some other events with WISE as well, and they do terrific job at what they do. And Paula was actually on their executive board for a while, has been a longtime member and executive board member. But we're here to not talk about WISE or me. We're here to talk about Paula and her book, and we're going to sell books afterwards. So afterwards, over at the table, Paula will sign books for you, and you have to buy one, maybe two. Right now, you're number 6 on the Amazon list?
Number 6 on the New York Times bestseller nonfiction list, and number 13 overall New York Times bestseller.
My recent thing on Abu Sayyaf was number 27 on CSIS list.
That's awesome. Way to go.
I think 500 people read it last month. But anyhow, we're fortunate today to be joined by Paula. Her new book, and most of you heard about this, All In, was released on January 24th, had large number of pre-sales. I just mentioned that Paula has been a WISE member for many years. She's currently a research associate at Harvard's University's Center for Public Leadership and a PhD candidate. This is how you do a PhD, huh? You get double credit for it.
They let me flip it.
They won't. And she's in the candidate Department of War Studies, King's College in London, where she's working her PhD. She has published op-eds in the New York Times, which I know you have all read, International Herald Tribune, the Christian Science Monitor, Boston Globe. While writing All In, and she's going to talk much about this, she spent a year embedded with General Petraeus' staff in Afghanistan. She's lived, worked, and traveled in more than 60 countries during her 15 years of military service, doing geopolitical analysis and counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations. She served in the intel community, the U.S. Special Operations Command, the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Forces. She graduated from West Point with academic fitness and leadership honors. And those of you that watched the viral video, apparently it's viral, with your appearance with a push-up with John Stewart, where she raised money for a charity, but she's clearly athletically inclined. And she has a master's in honors from University of Denver and a master's in public affairs from Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. So those are a lot more academic credentials than I could ever hope for. These book events at CSIS are very informal, and that's what we're going to do. Paula's going to give us a brief overview of her thoughts about the book and her effort, and then I'm going to ask some questions. We're going to have a discussion, and then we're going to turn it over to you. I'm not going to go very long, and then we're going to move over to the sale. So, Paula, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
CSIS does.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And again, along with WISE, we really appreciate you doing this. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, to the crowd, and do some remarks. Thank you all.
Thank you for the very generous introduction. That's about everything. And thanks to WISE for believing me all these years and helping me to stay on course. You know, had a couple of babies in the last few years, and it was difficult to manage all of this. But I'm sure there'll be some questions about work-life balance. I'd like to speak to you a little bit about how I came to write the book and what the book is really about. And first of all, what I hope this book gives you is a portrait of strategic leadership. And I think there are lessons for parents dealing with small insurgents at home, for military commanders, obviously, dealing with crisis decision making and strategic decision making that involves 49 coalition country members, for example, and for young troopers, young leaders in the military and otherwise. You kind of see a portrait of how war plays out at that level and see how our young commanders are living and making decisions that have strategic implications. So I was studying at Harvard, and General Petraeus at the time was at Fort Leavenworth at the Combined Arms College, and he came to speak about the field manual he was writing at the time, the counterinsurgency field manual that he would use to guide troops operations in Iraq. And a group of veteran students were invited to have dinner with him. I was amongst the students, and I went up to him and said I was working on a project and would like to talk to his folks, and he might be interested in reading this truly brilliant thesis I had on negotiating with terrorists. And he was kind enough to give me his card, and we started a sort of email relationship. And he does this with a lot of young people, and I think it's one of his effective leadership techniques, in that he's willing to take a good idea. It doesn't matter where you work, what your gender is, what your background is. He's really into what he calls directed telescoping. So getting his feelers out there, having tentacles, if you will, in various networks has informed his situational awareness. Not that I contributed anything through that thesis paper, but anyway, it was the start of our email relationship. 2 years later, he had just commanded the surge in Iraq, and the violence had come down precipitously in the summer of 2007. It was 2008, and I sent him a note to say I was thinking of writing a dissertation, and could I examine his role in galvanizing organizational innovation. I wanted to explore how the military had evolved from more of a conventional fighting force to fighting coin. And he readily agreed. So we continued the email dialogue and would occasionally run together, and I would interview him. And I think that sort of solidified a new level of rapport, if you will. And I write about that in the preface of the book. When he went to Afghanistan, I had been working on my dissertation for 2 years. And the dissertation was really a look at how did this individual arrive at his personal beliefs about how we should fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. How should we fight and train and equip our force for the future? What would be the future threats? And I looked at the role of his social networks, specifically his mentors, and how they were training him, encouraging him to go to grad school, for example, the materials he was reading. I looked at his education and studied in depth the materials that he was looking at for his own dissertation. And I know some of you were at my talk earlier today, so sorry I'm repeating myself, but I looked at what kind of materials he was reading for his dissertation to try to figure out where did he get these beliefs. You know, was it Trinquiere or Galula and so forth? And then I looked at his experiences. And we profile all of this in the book in biographical digressions. Each chapter has a snapshot of some early point in his life where he's learning something, and then fast forward to a period in Afghanistan where it's sort of playing out on the battlefield. So, excuse me, I've been talking for about 2 weeks straight.
I'm not going to make you do push-ups, so
yes,
don't worry.
No, I'm ready if you need to. So I was examining all these variables and looking at letters of correspondence he had shared with mentors and friends at his own writings when he was young, and framing this in my dissertation. And when he was selected to go to Afghanistan, and we can talk about all of that unraveled, that's the wrong term, played out, I decided it would be a wonderful opportunity to try to flip the book and flip my dissertation into a book. And so I applied for an Afghan visa and just basically showed up over there. And he still thought I was working on the PhD and was willing to kind of support my travel around the country, as he did with a lot of other journalists and young students or old students like me. But he finally realized I was pretty serious about getting the scoop, if you will, when I sent him an email from the border of Pakistan showing my strange sense of adventure. I said, "We just got shot at. This is so awesome. You know, I'm having the time of my life." Not to make light of war, but you know, for me it was exhilarating to see what our troops were living through and how they're fighting every day in and out, and to sort of be part of it. So I ended up going to Afghanistan for about 3 weeks at a time, and come back to the States for 3 weeks and hang out with my children and go back and forth. And I think that was a good way to look at the war and to be able to track how it was progressing, how different cases, if you will, were progressing. I was embedded with troops in the field at the tactical level, but also spent a lot of time at headquarters with General Petraeus. And I would travel around with him on battlefield circulations. When I could, I was a fly on the wall in his meetings with Afghans or other government officials that came from coalition countries. And when he was back in Washington, I was able to attend his testimony in preparation for that. So really, the book has this war chronicle as the frame, if you will, and you're seeing the war that his last year, his ultimate command, you're seeing the war through his lens. So I try to kind of portray it through the Petraeus eyes. And then each chapter has a biographical digression, as I said, that takes you back and sort of informs you about his education. Some of the lessons learned were, you know, school of hard knocks, like how not to do things. You'll also find a number of his leadership techniques kind of surface, and I'd love to talk about that a little bit more in the question and answer period. That seems to be an area of interest in most of the interviews I've had so far. So we had a year to write the book. It was really intense for anyone who's written a book in real time. It was excruciating the last 6 months because of our editing deadlines. And now it's a bestseller, so I'm very proud of that. And I'm trying to take advantage of this national media platform to draw attention to wounded warrior issues and post-traumatic stress disorder. So we're donating 20% of our book proceeds to this group called Team Red, White, and Blue, and that's what I was competing with John Stewart to raise money for this group. For anyone who didn't see it, I challenged him to a push-up contest, and the loser had to pay $1,000 per push-up to this wounded warrior cause, and he lost by 20 push-ups. So he wrote a check for $20,000 right afterwards. So the wounded warrior issue is very important to me, and it's wonderful to be able to take advantage of this opportunity to focus Americans on their needs after seeing what they've gone through.
Well, congratulations. This is fantastic. It's good to see someone again with your background and understanding and serving the military, and to be able to produce, you know, a piece like this is, you know, just it's a great accomplishment. Let's talk a little bit about your access that you had. You show up in Afghanistan. How much you had the placement for sure. But how much access did you have to General Petraeus, and how did some of the other, how did the other staff perceive you? You know, who is she? What is she doing? And is this classified? And can she talk about this kind of stuff?
Right. Yeah. Well, there was some question about that because I'm still a reservist. I'm Major Broadwell, and I have a top secret SCI clearance. So some people question why I was in civilian clothes and what access should I have, but I had to sign away my life and sign non-disclosure agreements as if I was a journalist, because I was ostensibly there as an embedded journalist. I was able to sit on classified meetings, but I knew well enough what I couldn't talk about. And I worked with Colonel Meese, Mike Meese, who was the Deputy Chief of Staff for Petraeus, to ensure that I wasn't violating OPSEC. Mm-hmm. So originally we had some interesting stories about Joint Special Operations Command and some activities they were doing on night raids, and then the tactical exploitation that follows, and it was apparently too much to put in a book. So I had to redact some of that information. But in general, as I said, I had exclusive access to Petraeus's letters of correspondence and some small journals, and you know, Holly Petraeus helped me as well. So I think in that regard, I had unique access to the family. To the commander, I was sitting in on the morning briefings, basically followed him wherever he went. And it really took until my fourth or fifth visit for him to again realize that I was serious, and he kind of gave this blank command to his troopers to try to support me however I needed.
Now, you spent obviously a lot of time in the interviews and a lot of time at the staff elements, you know, watching these meetings and high-level meetings and these discussions, which are obviously critically important to developing his character and giving the background on him. But you also, as you mentioned, spent a lot of time in the field. Can you talk about how that balance worked and things that you saw in the field and how they influenced what you saw in the meetings, what you saw in the meeting and how it was portrayed in the field, and maybe something that where you saw synergies, where you saw disconnects?
Right, so I tried on every trip to spend a week or two, and sometimes my full trip would be embedded with the troops. And there were three battalion commanders that we profile in the book. And the idea is to show how the strategy plays out on the ground. In two of the battalion commands, war is not going well. In fact, they lose. So it's interesting because some people think I was writing a really rosy story and that we're winning in Afghanistan. But in fact, I show two areas where it's an under-resourced campaign. It's just not going well. It's very difficult. But one particular unit that was well-resourced, it was an artillery regiment that was repurposed as an infantry battalion, and they had a lot of support from Special Ops. They had a full partnership with an Afghan battalion, and a lot more money and enablers, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms. They flipped the Argandab River Valley area that they were covering from this very violent IED-laced terrain. Probably every 20 meters there was an IED going left or right. I mean, you really just could not move through this terrain. And there's an article in The Atlantic that profiled how bad it was in the summer of 2009. This unit gets there. They're fully supported. And I kind of take you through their experience. And some parts of the book are rather graphic because, I mean, we've all watched war movies. You've been watching these wounded warriors come back. But to see what some of these troops are going through and losing their buddies and, you know, losing limbs and they're sitting there trying to resuscitate them is, I thought it was important to try to make, to help the reader identify with really how difficult this terrain and this type of war is. But in the end, that unit ended up losing, I think, 8 troopers. Mm. But they did clear the Argandab, and they held it and were able to start building local governance initiatives. And now, at the end of my book writing experience, I went back to that area and was able to play catch with a pomegranate with little kids and sit and have a picnic with Afghan elders. So it was really transformed in that area. So you asked about the disconnect between headquarters probably in Kabul and the news that makes it back to Washington. One thing that really struck me coming back and forth so often was that the good news never makes it back here. You always hear the bad news. And there is a lot of bad news. It's hard all the time, as the commanders like to say. But I think what I saw, the disconnect between the troops in the field and the command, was that they often don't know the good news that's coming out of the lower levels as well. Mm. So that's one thing Petraeus did differently. He had a really intense, he likes to say, relentless communication format. And he had these morning video teleconferences where he would speak to the entire command to communicate his vision and also to elicit, you know, best practices and to be able to inform other commanders what's going on around the theater, so to increase their situational awareness. And he has these four key tasks of a strategic leader. The first is to get the big idea right. And the big idea in these wars for him was to focus on protecting the population. Protect the population from the insurgents, then you can win their hearts and minds. We can build, you know, we have, once the security, the surge or military operations are complete and have cleared an area, then we can start to build and hold. And ideally, they can provide their own security for themselves. That's the big idea. But how to do that? You have to communicate the vision. And we had a question earlier today at Georgetown from this young trooper, I think an E5 enlisted man. And he said he never really understood what he was supposed to be doing. And one of Petraeus' favorite mantras is, in the absence of orders, figure out what should have been done and execute. So as a commander, you clearly have to communicate to your troops, and that, you know, regardless of whether you're the head of a think tank or a military organization, you have to communicate to your troops what they should be doing. So he was really intent on trying to educate the force through those morning stand-up briefs, through his battlefield circulations where he went down there, and I think it really improved his situational awareness. And then the third task is to oversee the implementation of these big ideas, so thus the traveling. And the fourth idea is to create a lessons learned feedback mechanism so you can really learn from others in the organization and your organization can grow and adapt. So I didn't feel a real disconnect once he finally hit his stride there. If you have an example to give me, maybe I can address it specifically. But
no examples. well, one of those lines, because Petraeus obviously took over the job at a very crucial time. I mean, McChrystal had just been relieved under the Rolling Stone controversy. You know, he was the guy who was going to come in there, for President Obama and change the way the direction of the war was happening. And so you had this perturbation in the plan, the strategic plan, and Petraeus is assigned to come and take over for McChrystal. What do you think that, what was he able to accomplish? What did he change, if anything? You touched on some of the things about the communication plan, but what was he able to change in his time there before he left? What were his accomplishments?
The big thing that he achieved, I think, was what the president asked him to do, and that was to set the conditions for transition to begin. And we're all watching these headlines about now is 2013 the new 2014 as far as the drawdown is concerned. But the president asked him to start to set up the whole process. I mean, it's quite a process, and it's a nebulous one. It's very dynamic. And he had done it before in Iraq, so he knew that playbook. So they established the conditions to set up transition to begin. And that meant getting the coalition members, the 49 countries, to buy into it as well, to agree to stay through 2014. So he was very active in nurturing those relationships. And I like General McChrystal very much. I work for him. I have high respect for him. But one thing I think he wasn't good at was those diplomatic relations and corralling allies, if you will. So that's one strength Petraeus brought to the table. and I think he was more effective at managing the coalition. Another initiative he started that had been underway with the Special Operations Community, the Green Berets, is the Village Stability Operations, mm-hmm. Afghan mm-hmm. Local Police Initiative, but it was formalized under Petraeus' command. So the Afghan Local Police Initiative is a program that tried to train and equip remote villagers to provide security in those areas where the Afghan National Security Forces and our forces couldn't provide support. So we focus our operations on sort of major population centers and corridors of travel and so forth, but in between, these areas were insecure. So they've now stood up, I think, 10,000 Afghan local police. It's small mm-hmm. compared to the 300,000 Afghan National Security Forces that are protecting the population centers and so forth. But they create a kind of chain link fence. And the discussion lately in the news has been about moving from our conventional operations to a much more special operations mm-hmm. focused campaign there. But my argument against that would be you can't grow special operations guys overnight, as you know. It's difficult to recruit those types of leaders, and it takes a long time to give them the language training, obviously the military training, the special elite training that they have. So what Petraeus did during his time there was he recognized the limits of their capability, and he started augmenting them with conventional military. So it's very strange to augment conventional military to special forces, but it was something he had tried in Iraq, and it helped to kind of expand the impact, and they did great. So there may be more of that. But another initiative that he started was anti-corruption effort. I can't say, in all honesty, that they accomplished much there. Off the record.
That's an objective analysis, right?
it's very difficult. Obviously, you have to change a culture, a generation. It takes a generation to impact any change. But Brigadier General H.R. McMaster, promotable now, was selected to lead that initiative. And he didn't really have any background in it, but he's a smart guy, and he brought in a great team. And what they really tried to identify was islands of integrity in Afghanistan. That's what they called them. So individuals that were doing something right in the Afghan government to sort of praise them and emulate them, and then other people, corrupt leaders, are supposed mm-hmm. to want to be like that. It didn't quite work like that, I guess. But they did uncover, where the most pervasive areas of corruption were. At the borders, a lot of money being siphoned out.
Sure, sure.
A lot of money being in weapons and drugs and everything else being smuggled out of the airport. So at least starting some kind of initiative to address this was something I guess he should take credit for. Another initiative was a rule of law field force that was started under Mark Martins, Brigadier General Mark Martins, who's here in Washington. He helped to establish the rule of law program in the green zones in Iraq. Are there any veterans in the room? Any military folks? Okay. You guys could probably speak more about this than I could. But Mark Martins was in Afghanistan before Petraeus got there and had been working on detention issues and other rule of law issues. But one of his key initiatives under Petraeus was to start training Afghans and bringing in more allies to help with this because we just don't have the JAG capacity, but helping them to establish local rule of law initiatives because that's one area where the Afghan government just cannot compete with the Taliban and their Sharia law. Their sentences are brutal, cut off your hand if you steal, but the issue is resolved. And so there was a big effort to try to establish rule of law. Again, that'll take a generation if it ever gets going, but those are kind of the key things.
Before we turn it over to the audience here, which is growing, thank you all for coming. Before we turn over to the audience for questions, let's talk about Petraeus as the man, as the individual, for a moment. I believe in many ways that greatest strength of an organization or greatest strength of your individual is also their weakness. So I'll lead the question with that. What are some of Petraeus's greatest strengths as a leader that you saw, and what personality traits do you think will best serve him in the role? I'm going to combine these two questions as the CIA director, which is a very different mission. Those of you that are familiar with the military and familiar with the intelligence community, they in many ways couldn't be two different, personality organizations with different personalities. And I'd be interested to see how you think he's going to do over the long term this role. I know he already has him running laps around the and you have to go through a physical fitness test to get to the seventh floor now at the CIA. But other than that, I'm curious what you think about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so strengths. Yes, some of his strengths are his weaknesses. This intense drive and this ambition and this competitiveness that has driven him to be the best at every assignment that he's ever been in is also a weakness because he offends his peers. And I think people think that he's done it to elevate himself. I will say that I think his ego is tied up in serving the nation. And so he's driven to exceed, but it's all for service. It's for the country to excel. It's for his organizations to excel. And that's who you want leading, you know, in the tough problem sets out there. I think one strength he has that he will take, he's used in the military and he will use at the agency, is his ability to understand and look at the world as a system. And to see how, like an engine, you know, all like a clockwork, almost like all these little wheels are cranking and they're related. So how do I get the 16 members of the intelligence agency to work more closely together? In Iraq, it was how do I bring in coalition members and, you know, interagency process. In Afghanistan, he's thinking about the different, you know, coalition members again. So just understanding how your organization works as a system and how the second and third order effects if you change one variable, to be academic about it, will impact the rest of the organization is a great strength. I think one thing that a lot of people don't know about him is that he's a relentless mentor, and he really cares about the next generation, and he cares a lot about what young people have to say, and sometimes thinks they have more to offer than older generations that are more set in their ways. Obviously, he values everyone's opinion. There's a great book by Cass Sunstein called Infotopia, and it talks about his kind of approach to reaching out to different networks and crowdsourcing, if you will, which is atypical, I think, for some military officers, especially to reach outside of the military boundaries. And we all know about his reputation of bringing in human rights activists to write the COIN manual and sort of skeptics of COIN in general. I think that's an effective leadership technique that he's also using now at the agency. He has brought in non-government and non-intelligence folks to meet with his analysts to give them an outsider perspective. I think some of this was going under Panetta, but he's kind of taking it to a new level. Other strengths. He has this amazing ability to manage stress. And you can imagine the weight of the world is on him or any military commander at that level. I see it now with General Allen. But with the weight of the world on his shoulders, he can still keep his mask of command on. And I think that takes a really, really strong person. And I was able to see behind the mask a little bit this last year with him and with other commanders. And you realize that that rucksack is heavy, you know, that they're carrying with the, for example, he keeps letters from spouses and children and wives of troopers who've died that written him, and he writes a letter back to every single person personally. He really cares about them and doesn't, I think, look at troops as fungible. But you don't really know that because you just see this driven commander you know, win at all costs. But it's I guess it's inspirational to see leaders at that level are still compassionate and caring.
I mean, his story is not, you know, done, because obviously the CIA and his career in many ways could still be rising. But from a military perspective, from his time in the uniform, what was his greatest contribution? What's his legacy as a military officer?
Let me answer one question you didn't ask first.
Okay.
How he got the CIA job.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people are interested in that. So if anyone's read the book, you'll know that he wasn't even considered for the chairman job. And for such a driven, talented, accomplished officer who two presidents had asked to step in and turn the tide of two wars, he was really offended by that and hurt. He was told by Secretary Gates in the fall of 2010 that his name wasn't even being thrown in the hat. He wasn't given reasons, but it was probably because Washington is only big enough for one superstar and you're not it.
And that's not true.
But he didn't miss a beat, and he said, how about, actually Gates first offered him the Chief of Staff of the Army or Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. And he had once sort of been intrigued by those positions, but he felt he was beyond it, and not in a pejorative sense, but he proposed the CIA. And Gates took the idea back to the president. Gates thought it was fabulous, having served there himself. The president thought it's a great way to keep him on the team, you know, team of rivals sort of approach. And I think also recognized what value he would bring to the agency. And that is, he's been a consumer of intelligence for decades. All of these military commanders are. But intelligence drives operations. So, you know, he's been the one running the operations. He knows where the weaknesses are or the gaps and what he'd been receiving. So he's bringing that sort of knowledge of having been a consumer. He also had worked on several interagency task forces, including those with high-level CIA reps, and had worked closely with operators in the field going back to Bosnia. One of the digressions in the book, we show how He goes to Bosnia before 9/11, is working on a war crime mission. And 9/11 happens, and it switches to a counterterrorism mission because terrorists are moving from Afghanistan through the Balkans up into Europe. And he helps to start this joint interagency counterterrorism task force, and it's a bunch of special mission units, and including CIA operators, Delta Force guys, and so forth. And it's really a big part of his education on how they work together and don't work together so well.
Yes.
And so he takes that model there, that joint interagency task force, and uses it in Mosul in Iraq. And really, you know, counterinsurgency has to be a whole-of-government approach. The military can't do everything. State Department can't do everything. So he was really trying to bring everybody into the tent. The other thing I think he brings to the table for the agency is obviously field experience. And a number of colleagues I have that are at the agency, former colleagues I should say, value that he can understand what it's like to be in the field operating. And they also value, I think at the higher levels, he's got this prolific network. He knows, you know, the Prince of Saudi Arabia, you know, key individuals in Pakistan, and they come to him. And not to say that Panetta didn't have that or other leaders don't, but he's got a prolific network. He hit the ground running there, and I think he's also had a learning curve, different organization, as you said, but he was well prepared for the job.
Well, great. Thank you for the conversation. We'll go ahead and open it for questions now. We have some microphones that are going to be around the room here. Please, if you could, we'll start with the gentleman in the back. Please state your name and your organizational affiliation, if you have one, and ask a question. No statements, please. This is a casual setting.
Hi. Is it on?
Yep.
Tom Coyle, U.S. State Department, West Point, Class 97. I had a question. From your observations, just watching General Petraeus, maybe other decision makers, were you ever there walking around thinking, well, I would have done that differently, or maybe think maybe privately you disagreed with a particular approach or strategy that you would have done differently? And if so, what was that?
Right out of the chocks, huh?
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, actually, I mean, on some level, I think I was a directed telescope for Petraeus, and I would tell him things like, you know, I think that there was a village raising in the Argandab River Valley. And this particular village had been laced with IEDs, and nobody was living there anymore. The Taliban had driven the inhabitants out. And so the only way this unit could really clear the village was to destroy it. So that kind of reeked of Vietnam, raising a village to save it. And this kind of blew up in the press. There was a lot of blogging about it. And he immediately contacted the Afghan government and was trying to get them to condemn what had happened, or condemn... Excuse me. They were saying that we had raised the village with the Afghans in it, and we hadn't. So he was reaching out to them to try to get them to retract their statement, and really became animated or exercised, as he said. This is not a good example, but just usually he can control his emotions really well. But I think that he lost it in that case, and it was one incident where I think it was fair enough to go off and say, you know, to call him on it. That's not a very good example. I won't pretend to think that I could tell a four-star commander really that the strategy was wrong. I gave him feedback on how things were going that I saw in the field, but there weren't any major sort of corrections I could think of. Well, that's a hard question.
It's a hard question. Good question. All right, we'll go ahead to the gentleman in the front right here.
Thank you very much. Raghubir Goyal, India Globe and Asia Today. My question is that covering the Pentagon and the White House almost every day and State Department, what will you say the future of Afghanistan, because many countries are worried after the U.S. and NATO leaves soon, now sooner than what they have been expecting. And some countries maybe will be happy that this operation will be over because Al-Qaeda will be back again. What do you think, what message do you have for the President and for Secretary Panetta?
The discussion you're talking about is probably a more precipitous drawdown of troops. I think I personally think that won't happen, having discussed this with General Allen and some of the other senior decision makers at the Pentagon. We are committed with our allies to staying through 2014. The question is, when will we start to draw down and at what pace and what number of troops? A surge forces will be out later this year, the 22,000 I think are left. But the rest of the forces that are there will continue to serve in an overwatch position. And they're working arm-in-arm with the Afghan National Security Forces. As I mentioned earlier, there are over 300,000 of those forces, and their capabilities are mixed. Some are, I went to see some of their training sites, and I don't do drugs, but I could sure smell some marijuana in several of these locations. And they're, you know, sometimes blatant about that drug abuse, and you can see how, wow, how are they going to take over for their own security if there's drug abuse, you know, illiteracy, just the give a crap factor is kind of low, excuse my language. But in other units, you see these incredible troopers who are proud to serve their country. They're very capable. They have the literacy rate of, you know, of elementary school, which is good enough for the work that they need to do. Even some more elite units like Afghan commandos, which are very important for this counterterrorism mission, are doing very well. So I'm hopeful that we can transition to an Afghan lead in the time frame that is available. But the question about what can we expect in the future of Afghanistan, not Switzerland, as the commanders like to say, but a stable country that al-Qaeda can no longer find safe haven in training there. There are still elements of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan right now, even with the force presence we have, about 24 or less, is what I understand. But even while we transition to an Afghan lead and we start to pull our combat forces back, we're sending security force advisors over there to embed with units. And these are smaller special forces type operators, but even conventional infantry officers who will serve in a kind of mentoring role. And we've done that before. This is the bread and butter mission of the special forces community, the Green Berets. So I'm hopeful, but it's hard, and we certainly can't predict that it's going to end good, and especially if we leave early. I think leaving any earlier than 2014 really puts the mission at risk. That's Paula's opinion. I'm not representing Petraeus or anyone.
He was obviously so instrumental in a turnaround in Iraq, and then, you know, obviously then moved over to Afghanistan. How closely did he stay engaged in what was happening in Iraq, even though that was no longer his true mission set anymore? And do you have any insights into what he sees as the future of Iraq? Because I think what happens there in the coming years is going to have an impact on what we do in Afghanistan as far as staying, leaving, and resourcing.
Absolutely. Well, as you know, he spent about 4.5 years in Iraq. And when he got to this position in Afghanistan, it was his entry-level position. So huge learning curve and not a lot of time to do it. Iraq, I think because of those 4.5 years and everything he experienced there, that was his first combat mission as the 101st Airborne Division commander. He lost a lot of troopers. That was his first experience losing troopers. And he lost Iraqi friends that he was very close to. And he really holds Iraq near and dear to his heart, you know, if I can candidly say it, more than Afghanistan. He really had much more formidable experience there. So he keeps tabs pretty closely, obviously, at the agency. But even watching him while he was in Afghanistan, he has his directed telescopes there. He has the think tankers from here that were frequently over there. He has a lot of Iraqis that write him. And occasionally I would get blind copied on an email to kind of see what was going on, what he was tracking. So he cares very much about it. And as you can imagine, I'm sure the agency has a presence in Iraq, so he's keeping an eye in that regard as well. And he's very concerned. I think he's really concerned that this could devolve very quickly. Mm. But he was there in January, and he brought a a picture to Maliki of George Washington and just gave it to him. And the symbolism was, we have given you, I mean, we screwed up, but we have given you this opportunity now to recreate your country, to start something great. And it was kind of, it was a really special moment, apparently. I wasn't there, but from what I've heard. But the chance is theirs now. I mean, we can sit and overwatch. We're not going to send troops back in response, but he cares very much about it.
Okay, right. Another question from the audience? Okay, Jolene, right in the front, yeah.
Jolene Shoemaker from WISE. Paula, as you know, WISE is really about leadership development for women, women's advancement in the field of peace and security. And I just was curious if maybe you could elaborate on some of the leadership lessons also for women and men in the civilian sector who may not have the military experience and are, you know, very seeking those leadership lessons and advice.
Sure. Thanks. Well, I mentioned earlier his kind of four strategic leadership principles, or key tasks. I can go into those a little bit more. And they're so simple, but if you think about every time I've written something or done a project, and I might share it with him. He's always like, did you get the big idea right? What are you trying to communicate here? And that you know, even goes down to writing a paragraph. Is the first sentence the theme, and then do the subsequent sentences support that? So you got to get the big ideas right. And you know, for us as Americans, what's our grand strategy? And you know, that's a question, a rhetorical question. But for him, it was, how can we win in these wars? And then, as I said before, communicate those ideas, oversee their implementation, and then find a way to get the lessons learned back into the system so you can grow and evolve. The other sort of behaviors that I witnessed from him are, number one, he has just this incredible positive attitude. And he would send troopers Charles Swindoll quotes about attitude and you know, you choose how you react to the down when life doesn't go the right way. And people think he's had this wonderful trajectory and always gotten whatever he wants, but he has had obstacles all along the way. He wanted to join the Rangers with Stanley McChrystal when he was a captain, but he got pulled up to work for General Galvin as an aide. So he missed that opportunity, but he made the best of it. And Galvin then becomes his most formidable mentor, encourages him to go to Princeton for a PhD, takes him to the Supreme Allied Command in Europe, and he gets to see this strategic leadership, so it's part of his important education. It was thought that he was put out to pasture when he went to Fort Leavenworth, and he wasn't given the command of the 82nd Airborne Division. And so he actually turned that into an incredible opportunity to reshape the Army. It was thought that he was being put out to pasture by going to the CIA. And you know, when people speculate about the fact that he wasn't given the chair, and as I said, he was kind of hurt that he wasn't even considered, he turned it into a positive. And he is so in love with that workforce, and he has this attitude that the best organization is the one you belong to, wherever you're at. And he applies that to family. He just sings the praises of his family. He sings the praises of his unit that he's so positive about it that you just start to believe it because he's so positive about it. And he gets in trouble for being a little too positive, as you know, with he was criticized over being positive about the Iraq war and the progress they were achieving and the surge was there. So attitude is everything, and that's something you can preach to the choir, but we're in charge of our choices and our attitudes, so that's something you can change as well. The other thing is, I can talk all day about it.
We'll go to Rick up here, to Will. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm Rick Interfirth with CSIS. Could you talk a bit about a country in Petraeus' view that you haven't mentioned, that is Pakistan, the whole question of the sanctuary, and about his views? He once referred to Richard Holbrook as his wingman. How did he feel about the diplomatic side of this effort? Everybody says that there can be no military solution. It has to be political.
Right.
And what is his thinking about the political side of this, and how successful have the diplomats been in establishing conditions in which the military gains can be realized?
Well, first of all, let me talk about Holbrooke and the wingman comment. I think, I had an interview with Bruce Rydell, who ran the Afghan review for the president, and it was basically Bruce, Holbrooke, Clinton, and Petraeus. And Holbrooke was the de facto lead of it. Well, Bruce Rydell, but he was seen as the lead. But everyone on the team, including Bruce Rydell, said Petraeus ran the show. He knew everything. He'd been to that theater. He had the connections, and Holbrooke didn't at that point. So, and there's a quote in the book about that. Petraeus himself was, you know, he's a type A personality, and so is Holbrooke. So there, and maybe you saw the two interact. I don't know if you ever saw the two interact, but. I think usually Petraeus would be deferential to him, but there was probably a mutual respect for each other's knowledge. I didn't get to see the two interact. Looking more broadly at the diplomatic effort, Petraeus would have loved to have Crocker come back to Afghanistan with him. He was really hindered by Eikenberry's presence there. As you know, the cable that Eikenberry had sent back to Washington leaked. Karzai was offended by everything he'd said in there, and just it ruined their relationship for the rest of Eikenberry's term there. He was so mercurial when Eikenberry would come to the palace that Petraeus just stopped bringing him, frankly. Hmm. Petraeus, when he left the White House, when he first found out he got the job, he immediately called Brian Crocker and asked him to come, and Crocker was willing to come out of retirement. He was in Texas at the Bush School of Government, I think, at the time. And the White House, I guess, couldn't make it happen, and I'm not sure why it took so long, but Petraeus would have liked to have his old wingman back. They worked very closely together. Mm-hmm. And as you've heard him say many times, it really requires unity of effort. I didn't see that in Afghanistan as much as we saw it in Iraq. Both Eikenberry and Petraeus said they had it, but they clearly got along. They were collegial, but there wasn't they weren't best friends, that's for sure. But I didn't think that at the end of the day that Eikenberry really believed in the mission. And I had several interviews with him, and he basically said, why are we sending more PRTs or this rule of law field force? There's nothing we can do here. And I'm thinking, if somebody doesn't believe in the mission, they should step down from that position. Pakistan. One of the biggest issues, obviously, in our foreign policy concerns right now, and it has been on Petraeus' radar for some time. While he was at CENTCOM, he worked very closely with Pakistan. So he was there in 2008 through 2010, and the relationship was pretty positive then. There were still some issues, but we had this series of bad events, as you know. The WikiLeaks, Bob Woodward's book, Obama Wars, kind of showed that our administration didn't trust them, and the WikiLeaks showed that they didn't trust us. The Raymond Davis the CIA agent or contractor who had killed two Pakistanis. The Bin Laden raid was huge, and it really hurt our cooperation and security force assistance initiatives there. This is when we start to pull back some of the special forces troops we had there training and helping their guys to fight in the Fatah. And you can understand their position. It's a sovereign nation, and we didn't ask them, but we feel like they probably knew something about it. So I can go on and on. But the relationship, as you know, has continued to deteriorate. And he seems very concerned about it. I'm not going to pretend I'm his spokesperson. He doesn't give me his innermost thoughts on Pakistan, but he's continuing to work the relationship pretty hard. And I don't know a way ahead. It's like an arranged marriage. We're just going to have to work it out.
Well, I wish this we had the webcast.
Not very helpful.
We'll go over here in the front. And then we'll go over to you, Richard.
I'm Kathy Gokel. I'm a consultant currently working with WISE, actually. Paula, having known you for a while, can you explain a little bit of what your career trajectory has been? You might not see yourself as a mid to senior level person, but a lot of people do. And so what made you take this path, and what would you say are your biggest obstacles that you've had to overcome?
Well, I'll start at the beginning. It was 1991, and there I was.
I'll read book.
Choosing West Point, that was the first obstacle, right?
Yeah. I was watching the Gulf War on television, and I had applied to Georgetown and wanted to become a diplomat or get into international security, but I was watching the Gulf War, and I thought, as a woman, I need to understand that shock and awe thing and that instrument of power, and look at how quickly you can shape the world through this military. So I decided to also apply to the Air Force Academy because I was just thought the leadership training, and that sounded like a nice service. You could see the world. I won't give you the full story, but my senator who was giving me his nomination basically said, you want to change the world, but you don't want to fly. And those students outside the door, all their life they've wanted to fly. Why should I give my nomination to you? And before I could answer, he said, I'm going to give you my appointment to West Point. You should reapply, and I think that would be a great place for you. For all of the goals you want to achieve, that will help you get there faster. So fast forward, went to West Point. I chose military intelligence and had a lot of fun in that career field and wanted to try the different disciplines. So my first assignment was in Korea on the DMZ, and we had SIGINT intercepts, and we were jamming North Koreans. So it was kind of fun to listen in on their communications. I didn't really understand, but my troopers all spoke Korean. Then I went to Germany, and I was the senior intelligence analyst for the Middle East and Africa. So it was a lot of fun, got to travel. And Pete Ford is here somewhere. Pete was stationed there with me. We had a lot of fun. But it wasn't, it was a fun army. There wasn't really a big threat. And after that, I won't give you the full career, but I got into special operations community and was doing targeting for terrorists, and that was really rewarding. That was after 9/11. I had worked a little bit in counterterrorism analysis, but putting together targeting packages and using my background in all of these different intel disciplines was very rewarding, and then to see how it plays out, and you know, you feel like you're making a difference when you take a bad guy off the field. And then I worked in an FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is where we met in Denver. And then I got into the academic path, and that was because it was time to have babies, and my husband said you need to choose between a family and the military, because I had been recalled to active duty 3 times, as you know, after serving 5 years on active duty. So the rest is, you know, sort of the academic route, and you heard a little bit about that earlier. I was pursuing the PhD, and it led to this book, and here we are with a bestseller. So, the things that have given me the most joy in life are obviously family and serving something greater than myself, my country, and participating in WISE and mentoring young women. I felt like that was one challenge. You asked about challenges. I did not have a lot of or any mentors early in my career, so I feel it's fun now to be able to intervene and mentor folks, and men and women, and show them about opportunities and connect them. Other challenges.
What's next?
I have to finish the PhD. I definitely need some sleep. This tour is wearing me out, and I apologize. I'm not bright shining right now. But I've been working with Petraeus on actually a leadership book, a sort of short, you know, succinct leadership book that focuses on the business community. And I was offered an anchor job at CNN on Wednesday. So
congratulations. Good for you. Wow.
They apparently like somebody with some experience. So, yeah. So I'm not sure what's next. As many parents in here know, you have to balance your spouse's career and my children. So I'm fortunate that I married my best friend, and he's very supportive and of having an independent wife. and I'm thankful for that. But we'll see. But I have some short-term goals now. Just get through this day, and tomorrow we're on Charlie Rose and a couple other shows this week.
Wow.
I like taking advantage of the opportunity to speak about Wounded Warriors, and I feel like Petraeus will go on, his legacy will live on. You know, I'll have other opportunities, but right now is a neat opportunity to give back to that community.
That's great. I think we have time for one more question. We'll go to Dr. Southby over here to the right. Maybe a couple more questions. My watch is slow.
Thank you very much. I'm Richard Southby from Georgetown University. I wonder if you'd comment on the relationships General Petraeus had with the coalition leadership.
In Afghanistan?
Yes.
Well, he had basically a revolving door, and there was some member of some coalition country in his office basically every day, and he spent a lot of time on coalition management. He's always very positive about what allies were contributing, but it was one of his worst nightmares, to be honest. And he liked to quote Winston Churchill, "The only thing worse than having allies is not having any," and that's because it's so difficult to, you know, every country has different caveats and constraints and resources, and as a strategic commander, you need to understand what their capabilities are, what their strengths. I mean, think of any team that you have. You want to develop, you know, each individual to be all they can be. So fortunately, he'd had some exposure to many of these coalition members, and knew that. The Netherlands, for example, had great ISR platforms that they could contribute. And Japan wouldn't bring troops, but they care deeply about human rights issues. So trying to work with the leaders, whether it's a minister of defense or a head of state that came to visit, he spent a lot of time immersing himself and trying to understand what each player on the team could bring. One thing that really frustrated him was the lack of consistency of the capability of troops in conducting COIN. And we have that problem in our own military. Mm. Some units are better than others. But the Romanians, for example, they weren't leaving the FOB. They were not getting off the base. And you can't go in hearts and minds unless you leave the base. And they just kind of were waiting their time out there. Another thing that was frustrating is that some of these troops, foreign contributing nations, have short tours, 4 months, 6 months, and If counterinsurgency is premised on building relationships with the local people, that doesn't really go very far. So he enjoyed it as much as it was a headache. I think he liked being in that international arena. But that's part of the reason why he didn't want to go to NATO, to SACEUR. He just thought, I like to be an engine of change, and there's nothing changing about the NATO coalition.
All right, we'll go. We have to pick the former squadron mate or shipmate, as we say in the Navy, not the Army.
Peter Ford, I'm with Diplomatic Security. You're talking about General Petraeus' leadership. I had a personal experience. I was up in his 2000 congressional testimony. I listened to him for 7 hours. After that, I found myself calling up my buddy to volunteer to go to Iraq because I wanted to serve under him because I thought he had great leadership. And 30 days later, I was at Iraq, and I actually had a chance to serve under him for 6 months. So he's a good leader. That's the premise of the book and leadership. Where did he learn leadership? Did he learn it at West Point, or was he a born leader? Do you think West Point taught him this leadership?
Well, there's a bit of a nature and nurture argument. And in the early chapters, we show sort of what his most formative experience was, and that is dealing with his father. And his father was a Dutch sea captain who had been out to sea on a boat when the Nazis invaded Holland, and he couldn't go back. So he came to the U.S. and went to a soldier, sailor, and airman event in New York City and met Miriam Howell, David's mother. And this crusty old sea captain was very difficult to please, and he was never he would never accept excuses from David Petraeus, and it just drove the young David Petraeus to try to please his father more and more. And he would always say the words when the young Petraeus made some excuse, "Results, boy." And those words echoed in his head no matter where he was, even in Afghanistan. He knew he had to deliver, and he says that, you know, jokingly to mentees and so forth now, but it's all about delivering results. And so, you know, if that shaped his drive and his ambition to achieve and be a leader, I think it definitely did. But you know the West Point environment. It's they break you down and they build you up to become even more of a leader. But really, he was always driven, and he was always kind of goal-oriented. But learning the leadership techniques of a strategic leader, I think, really happened when he was at the elbow of four key mentors. And I profile four key mentors in the book. One was General Knowlton, who was the superintendent of West Point at the time. And I don't think he learned leadership from him, but he learned a lot about diplomacy and world affairs, and specifically Vietnam. He used to sit down at the dinner table with the Knowltons once he was engaged to the superintendent's daughter, and have these discussions about war and peace, if you will. The next key mentor was Colonel Keith Nightingale, whom nobody has really heard about, but he met this gentleman in the first of the 509th Infantry in Vicenza, Italy, which was the elite unit that the best and brightest went to. Remember, at that time, it was post-Vietnam, and the military was really at a nadir, so he was sort of sheltered from that by going to this elite unit that had more elite leaders who were mentoring him, and they would interact with units in Germany and back at Fort Bragg, who were also airborne units, and he would see like how the rest of the military was suffering, if you will, and you know, high rates of drug abuse and so forth, and alcohol abuse, but he was protected in this one unit. And Colonel Keith Nightingale was a plankholder of the Rangers, and then he went on to participate in the Iran hostage rescue situation, Eagle Claw. And then he helped to form JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Committee. So Petraeus has his mentor who all along, and I trace through their letters of correspondence, is kind of teaching him and coaching him about the proper use of special forces and special operations. And there's some leadership development in there, I think, as well, but that was maybe more substantive focus. And then he meets General Galvin. And General Galvin was the head of the 25th Infantry Division, and he pulled Petraeus from that Ranger billet that he wanted and designated him as his aide. And I got access to General Galvin's personal memoir, which he is unpublished and he won't disclose. And he writes about David Petraeus, and that he saw the spark in this young guy, and it reminded him of himself, and he was really going to try to develop him. But it was all about strategic leadership, even at that point when he was a captain. And he told Petraeus that as a strategic leader, you have to create a mythology, a mystique about yourself, and he called it the M factor. And it was he related to Ulysses S. Grant, who, you know, chewed on the cigar and, you know, had that kind of thing, and Patton and his pistols and always driving to the front line. And so he tried to encourage Petraeus to think about, what's your legacy going to be? And so people ask, what is Petraeus's legacy now, or what is his M factor? It's this genetic mutant PT stuff that he, you know, he does. I mean, he's really that's a strength of his, and he uses it to inspire others. He really does, and he's got this mantra of the ultimate, your body is the ultimate weapon. For an infantryman, as you know, that's really true. You have to defend yourself and prepare yourself for the most physical, strenuous activities. So Galvin also taught him about counterinsurgency. He brought him down to Central America, and there were 6 insurgencies going on, so he exposed him to that. But later, he then brings him to NATO command when Galvin himself is serving as a Supreme Allied Commander. And Petraeus gets to then write his speeches, and he's encouraging Galvin to give speeches on certain topics. You can see how he's shaping these senior leaders' thoughts and visions. I mean, really precocious for a young officer. And just that exposure at those levels, I think after that, you know, he had already developed his own leadership style and so forth, but read the book.
Well, we're going to go ahead and sign before we do a couple of the, could you want to talk once again about the foundation that you're supporting? I know it's 20% of the proceeds go, but is there a website or some other way people get interested and learn more about what you're supporting?
Yes, the group is called Team Red, White, and Blue, and there are chapters throughout the U.S. The USO has just picked them as a best in class for working with wounded warriors, particularly those with post-traumatic stress disorder. And there are approximately 500,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan who are suffering from this. So it's basically epidemic proportion, and this group is helping to reach out to them. The website is teamrwb.org. And if you like physical fitness, if you're running anyhow, it's a great group to get involved in. And you'd be amazed at how you can help transform a wounded warrior's life by running with them or encouraging them to join some kind of athletic activity in their area as a way to sort of regain esprit de corps and a sense of community that they've lost when they leave the military because of their wounds, if you will.
And I want to thank Jolynn and Wise for co-sponsoring this, for sponsoring this, and just letting me be the moderator. And then obviously all of you for attending. Thank you. This is a tremendous crowd. And then lastly, let's congratulate Paula and thank her for participating.
Yes, thank you
very
much. Appreciate it.
It's very awesome. That's okay. And now we're going to move to book signings. So if you want to go ahead and make a line, cash American, credit cards.